Do you know offhand?
12-ish.
12-ish, she says. And she's been a dynamic force here, someone that we have counted on in so many ways over the years. As we light this chalice, we recognize it as a symbol of all that we are, all that we have done together, and all that we will do and be as our shared ministry encourages those within and hopefully those beyond our walls. Would you please join me in saying our unison affirmation? This flame affirms the light of truth,
the warmth of community, and the fire of commitment. Love is the doctrine that we share. The quest for truth is our sacrament, and service is our prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve human need.
Thus do we covenant with one another. So each Sunday, our children collect food, and they know this is their cue, so I'm just getting ready. They collect food donations to provide food for those in need. And so we invite them to come forward now with that food and then sit up front for the Time for All Ages presentation.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Rachel White, and I'm the Director of Religious Education here at UUCF. And as Reverend Jason mentioned earlier, this Friday, April 19th at sundown begins the Jewish holiday of Passover. The Seder is a part of Passover. It's a feast that celebrates freedom. Today's story is a contemporary Passover story about the tradition of leaving an empty chair and goblet at the Seder table for the prophet Elijah, who is said to visit each Seder as a symbol of the modest traveler who represents all people. There once lived a brother and a sister named Leah and Sam. They were Jewish, and Passover was their favorite holiday because of the Seder. At the end of the Seder, their father poured wine into Elijah the prophet's goblet and asked the children to go and open the door for him. This was one of their favorite parts because it was so mysterious. They ran to the door and looked up and down the street. No Elijah. Leah came back to the table and asked, "Where is Elijah? Every year we pour him wine and open the door, but he never comes." "I have seen him," said her grandmother, "though I didn't realize it at first. Elijah comes in many disguises. I saw him long ago on a cold day just before Passover. I opened the door, and there stood a beggar. He was dressed in rags, and his shoes were full of holes. 'I am so hungry and cold,' he said. 'My parents worked hard and still had barely enough for a simple meal, let alone a Passover feast. We have nothing extra for you,' I said, and I shut the door. I peeked out the window and saw the beggar walk to our next-door neighbor's house. The mother worked very hard, taking and sewing, but she had many mouths to feed. I was sure she would turn the beggar away, but she opened her door and invited him in. The next day, my mother was cooking our Passover meal, and I was setting the table. Suddenly, there came a cry from the kitchen. Our dog had grabbed a chicken from the counter, knocking over the apple raisin pudding my mother was preparing. There was no money for it to buy another chicken or to make another dessert. We heard a knock on the door. It was our neighbor. 'It seems that misfortune has come to you,' she said. 'I would like to invite you to celebrate Passover at our house this evening. I don't have much, but somehow I was able to make more matzo balls than usual from my flour, and my soup kettle is full.' After our neighbor had gone, my mother asked me, 'Who was that knocked on our door while I was resting yesterday?' I said, 'It was a beggar. I told him we didn't have enough and sent him away.' 'Where did he go?' she asked. 'To the neighbors,' I shrugged. My parents looked at each other. 'Do you know who that beggar was?' my father asked. 'No,' "That was the prophet Elijah," said my mother. "He comes to see if we are helping to make the world a better place by being welcoming and generous." I didn't see Elijah again, but ever since then, I try to treat everyone as if they were Elijah, and I find that there's always enough. When my grandmother's story was finished, everyone was quiet. Then Sam asked, "What do you mean that you treat everyone like Elijah, Grandmother?" Grandmother looked at them and asked a question. "What was the last kind and welcoming thing that you did for someone?" Leah jumped up from the table. "I think Elijah would like us to invite our neighbors to celebrate Passover with us. Can we invite them to our Seder?" The new neighbors weren't Jewish. They had recently moved to the neighborhood from Haiti and didn't know many people yet. This was exactly the spirit of welcoming that Elijah taught. "Yes, go and tell them that if they would like to join our Seder meal, they will find our door open." It seemed that Elijah did visit that Passover day after all.
That story talks about recognizing when people are in need and how we can be welcoming to their needs. And that's one of the reasons that we share the joys and sorrows that are happening in our lives each and every Sunday here at UUCF. So if you do have a brief personal joy or sorrow that you'd like to share this morning, I invite you to come forward. This might be a burden that's too great to hold alone, or a joy that is too buoyant to be held just by yourself.
I show up infrequently, and I just love a microphone. I have a joy. 3 weeks ago, we returned from the Philippines, my wife and myself. While I was there, to liven up the trip, I got hospitalized with pneumonia. And the Philippine health system is different. I have a joy that the family and friends of the people in the Philippines took such great care and made sure I recovered. Of course, my wife was very instrumental in that also, but from the ticket agencies to the nurses to, I can't tell you how cared for I felt. And it was a great joy. Thank you.
Hi, I have a great joy to share. I actually have two, I'll make them fast, but I have on my phone a picture of my first grandson. His name is Finley Montgomery. He'll go by Finn, and he was 8 pounds, 10 ounces. He was born a week and a few days ago. Anyway, he's doing great. He's handsome and the prettiest baby in the world. Of course. Anyway, no bias. I'm also directing a play that's going on this weekend and for two more weekends. It's called The Crocodile Sings. It's about Tennessee Williams, and my friend Joe Parrish wrote it from the memoirs and is acting it, and it's wonderful. And it's at the Maverick, so it's very close, and I put little flyers on the back table. Thanks.
Good morning, I'm Mary Botts, and I have a joy. If you haven't joined one of the Chalice Circles, you should really consider doing that. And one of the things the Chalice Circles do is a service project, one for our church community and one for the community at large. And so yesterday, all of my group got up and met at my house at 7:30 in the morning, and we went to the La Puente Resource Family Resource Center, their service fair, and we worked that. And I just want to appreciate all of the people that went, and Laurel for providing that opportunity. And Laurel presented us with a certificate that I wanted to give you.
Excellent. Certificate of Appreciation awarded to Fullerton Unitarian Universalist Congregation for your continued support and participation in the 2019 Safe and Healthy Kids Fair. So excellent. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Nick Esposito, a newer member, but I have a really tremendous joy to share, and that's that myself and my wife, Barveen, we are expecting our first child. So she's about 20 weeks pregnant, and we're very, very excited. So.
Hi, for those of you who know me, my name's Jennifer Myers. And for those of you who don't know me, my name's also Jennifer Myers. That was... I have not been here since the end of February, and it might have been a lot longer, but my dental hygienist noticed something that was off. When I went to the endodontist, she said, nobody ever notices this stuff until it goes critical. I can't believe she spotted it. Well, infected stuff, lots of antibiotics, feeling yucky, a month or so, I'm way better. Still a little wobbly, but I'm actually not dying. And my dental hygienist noticed it. I was told afterwards, usually the first time people find out about something like this is a skull fracture. And I'm like, I went to Trader Joe's and stuffed a bag with everything awesome and brought it to my dental hygienist. You never knew who the smartest person in your world might happen to be.
Okay, so my ex-boyfriend, who I have not spoken to in about 5.5 to 6 years, recently sent me a long text apologizing profusely for his behavior during our relationship and said that now she has transitioned to become a woman and her name is now Serafina. And she has gone through extensive therapy and has now, you know, seen, you know the things that come with therapy, like, you know, getting greater self-awareness and, you know, seeing your toxic behavioral patterns and just going through all that stuff has really seemed, it really seems to have improved her as a person. And just, you know, going on estrogen has given her a whole new perspective on things. And it's just, you know, it's just, you know, she seems to be much better off, and I'm really, really happy for her.
So I happened to run into somebody outside on my way in this morning, a face that might be familiar to just a few of you, and he happened to share with me that this week he will celebrate his 90th birthday, and I think that that's something special, and I think we should sing happy birthday to him.
Well, we've had some joys and we've had some things to think about this morning. And as always, we know there is so much more happening in the lives of each and every person in this room. And as we move throughout the world, I hope we take that into consideration in all of our interactions with others. So as we begin our time of reflection and meditation, I was noticing the words of Reverend Naomi King this week. Reverend King is a Unitarian Universalist minister, and she's also the daughter of Stephen King. So if there's anybody who knows about good and evil, I always think it's probably Naomi King, right? But she says, as someone who identifies pretty strongly with the Christian Unitarian Universalist tradition, she says the traditions surrounding the Holy Week liturgies and texts have sometimes given themselves to violence and anti-Semitism. And she asked that as people approach Holy Week, to let us attend to halting and dismantling theological traditions of hate and anti-Semitism that are in the world. And we're going to be talking about that more deeply this morning. So I just wanted to lift up the complexity of sometimes the times that come around annually with holidays and so on, that it is a complex world we live in, and the things that we celebrate can also have another side to them that can be oppressive to some people. So I begin with a meditation from David O. Rankin, and I invite you into the spirit of prayer, reflection, and meditation. Palm Sunday is found whenever we are serving a noble and unpopular cause with selfless devotion, holding to the ideals of truth and justice. Whenever we are seeking to uplift the fallen, to comfort the brokenhearted, to strengthen and encourage the weak and hopeless. Whenever we are working bravely and persistently in the face of abuse and criticism to establish more equitable relations in the world. Whenever we are sacrificing our lives in behalf of what we believe to be the service of love for all humanity. Let us hold together a moment of silence as we consider what it is to truly love humanity, especially in turbulent times. That was probably the future calling again. Spirit of life and love, let us look into our consciences, our hearts, and let us face what we see out in the larger world, the concerns that we have for others who are persecuted or oppressed, marginalized or mistreated. And even as we see what may happen on the national stage and the global stage, let us not forget to consider what might be happening in our own backyards. Let us look toward the signs that suggest that we indeed are called to take responsive action in the world, to help to make it a better place, to help to stamp out evidence of anti-Semitism and prejudice, bigotry, racism, homophobia, whatever we might see out in the world that needs our attention. Let us continue to pay attention. And above all, let us never be hopeless. Let us be willing to engage with hope, even when finding hope can be hard. Let us sing that song together of hope, walk together in rain or shine. And let us find in the perfection of a rose the beauty that we need to remind us how wonderful this world can be. Let us be open. Let us be willing.
Change. hurting in my family. There is sorrow in my town. There is panic in the nation. There is wailing the whole what seems so strange. It dishonors those who go before us. So lift me up to the light of change. May the children see more clearly. May the elders of change caress us, even though it burns our eyes. I am open and I am willing to be hopeless. What seems so strange, it dishonors those who go before us. So lift me up to the light of change. Give me a mighty oak to hold my confusion. Give me a desert to hold my fears. Give me a sunset to hold my wonder. Give me an ocean to hold my tears. I am open and I am willing to be hopeless. What seems so strange, it dishonors those who go before us. So lift me up to the light of change.
So in just a moment, we're going to hear from our guest this morning, but I wanted to introduce her first. Leslie White is the Holocaust educator at, how does it pronounce? Tarbut Betora Community Day School in Irvine. She's been studying the Holocaust for about almost 20 years now, graduating from Loyola Marymount University with a degree in history. And she was mentored by world-renowned Holocaust scholar Dr. Michael Barenboim. She has worked for the Simon Wiesenthal Center Museum of Tolerance and is currently a docent at the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust in Pan Pacific Park. And she also educates and facilitates for the ADL and has recently been accepted to a two-week program at Yad Vashem in Israel this summer. And she was also very briefly my wife. Yeah. This is in a play. So that's not a story you haven't heard before or anything. But Leslie's made the news lately, and so when I saw her name in print in various newspapers, I thought, well, we have to have her in to tell this story. So let us all give Leslie a very warm welcome.
Thank you.
So, Leslie, it's wonderful to have you with us this morning. And before we start asking you some questions here, I would like to just kind of explain to people the background for what prompted this, the story that happened. And I'm sure you probably heard about this. It was as recently as March, I think, and it was Newport Harbor High School.
Yeah.
And several of their students were seen in photos saluting and... A swastika was made out of the red plastic cups at a weekend party. I think we have some photos here.
Oh, yeah, that looks familiar.
And it showed teens laughing and toasting over the swastika and some kind of drinking game. There were students from Costa Mesa High School and Estancia High School also involved, according to the Los Angeles Times. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that story. I know a lot of people in this room saw that story, and we were really, really both shocked and not surprised at the same time. And I think as we think about the idea of prejudice in our own backyard, anti-Semitism right in our own backyard, this was a real wake-up call for a lot of us. And so Leslie has an interesting, she's played an interesting role in helping with some of the healing regarding this incident in education. But first I'd like to ask you, Leslie, how did you initially hear about this and what was your response at the time?
Well, funny enough, I actually heard from a colleague of mine. She's a math teacher, and she was texting me and she goes, "This is happening right now." One of our students had texted her like pictures from this party and saying like I'm not a part of this. This was a screenshot from a friend of ours, and this is going on right now. So, you know, the initial reaction I have is, you know, tell the ADL, you know, tell the regional director of the ADL, you know, who used to be a rabbi, who is a parent at our school, and he'll be on this. And that was really late on that Saturday night. So they were, you know, having a house party, clearly, and by the next day, it was everywhere.
It was everywhere. I think I saw the Los Angeles Times article, and then, of course, as you said, it was picked up by so many newspapers throughout the country and was really everywhere.
I mean, people were, you know, they were telling our students, you know, they were getting messages from, like, Minnesota, Michigan, Israel. One of our students, her mother reads, like, you know, an Israeli newspaper, and it was in there.
Wow,
so it, the news traveled really, really fast.
Yeah, absolutely did.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was thinking about with your response to it is, you know, a lot of the work that you've done have been people who've been intentionally seeking out deeper understanding, you know, at the Museum of Tolerance or the Holocaust Museum or even just where you work, you know, people have a grounding and understanding. So when you see something like this happening, how do you process that? Because it seems so outside of any of the kind of reflective thoughtfulness that you might expect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't expect to see that kind of thing in 2019. You know,
In a privileged community.
In a privileged community, and assumably, you know, educated. And my first reaction was, wow, those kids don't really know anything about the Holocaust. That was just my first, you know, I didn't see Nazis. I didn't see, you know, a hate party or whatever that is. I saw some high school kids that desperately did not receive any Holocaust education. And I thought, you know, my first instinct is, wow, how can I help them? I reached out to their principal. And funny enough, Newport Harbor is the high school where I directed a production of The Diary of Anne Frank 5 years ago.
Oh, very ironic.
Yes. So all my kids had graduated, clearly. But even one of my students who was in school in New York at the time, she shared one of our pictures from the production, and she said, how can this beautiful, you know, event have happened just 5 years ago, and now this is happening? Yeah.
Well, before we get into your role a little bit, I just want you to go back and share with us because and maybe you've already sort of answered this question a little bit because your first response was, how can I help?
Yeah.
But what initially led you to this kind of work of working with the museums and being an educator around the Holocaust?
You know, I was raised Catholic, or so I thought. my parents, you know, I had my communion, and when, you know, middle school came around, I started learning about the Holocaust, and I started, you know, really becoming interested. I would beg my parents for like any book that they could buy me on the Holocaust. And that was, it'll show my age, that was when the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum was first open. And my mentor, Dr. Barenbaum, was on the committee, you know, the beginning committee of that. So, you know, he was friends with Elie Wiesel and, you know, Holocaust survivor and scholar, and they were instrumental in getting that museum built. But I read the book about the museum. I was just enthralled by this. It was like, and everything I would watch, it was like I was watching this happen to my own people. Like, what? Look what they've done to my people. And then I thought, you know, I knew I had to convert to Judaism, and it was a long road, but I did it. And it just reaffirmed everything that I had believed. So, and working with kids, working with kids at the museum, you know, who really don't know anything about the Holocaust, or even if they've been taught it in school, it's nice to keep that fresh, and just to hear, you know, their questions and, you know, what they can do to be better people. So
definitely. Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that it sounded like you were touching on is something we talk about here pretty frequently, is the idea of kind of figuring out, answering the call,
yeah,
whatever that
yeah
might be for you.
Yes.
And that is often a spiritual journey, it's a faith
yeah
journey, and it's also a call to action in the world, figuring out yeah what is it that I'm supposed to do in the world to make some kind of difference. And so
yes,
with that in mind,
yeah,
you got a call. I did.
Yeah, I did, after seeing these, you know, screenshots and hearing from a student of mine. The very next day, the rabbi at my school contacted me and said, those kids from the party are having a meeting tonight at one of the family's houses. No pressure, you know, you can go. He goes, I don't feel comfortable because it's such short notice, but... You know, I without hesitation, I said, I want to go. I will be there. Just give me the information. Because I knew they're high school kids. On some level, I can reach them and get to the bottom of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, you said it too. Like, one of my colleagues said, you never know when your call as a teacher is going to be, you know, you're
right,
going to be called
right
up.
Right.
So, I was... You know, my mom called me a first responder, you know, to this hate. It's like, you know, you want to go put this fire out.
Yeah.
So.
And what was that experience like when you actually met with them?
So when I got to the house, the dad walked me in and he goes, it's okay, you can say whatever you want to them, you know. And I go, hey, I'm not here to punish them. I just want to know why. I just want to know how this happened. And, you know, I got in, the mood was very somber. You know, they were all sitting in a circle with their parents. At least, you know, every student there had at least one parent.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked so scared. So just, it was like deer in the headlights. Like, what have I done? And I turned to them and I said, I know you're not Nazis. I wouldn't be here if I thought you were. So in that brief, you know, 2 hours I had with them, you know, I just kind of discussed with them what I teach my students about the history of the Holocaust, and, you know, how we can learn more about it so that we can be the bearers of that story. We can be the legacy, you know, because in 10 years, we're not going to have any survivors left.
Right.
So we are the ones who have to keep that story going.
And what do you think, I mean, as you spoke with them,
yeah,
I imagine, I mean, they probably had some awareness of this as an historical incident and
yeah
so on, but clearly there was a disconnect there. Did you feel like they made connections in that conversation that they had not made
oh
before?
Oh, yes. They realized in that short amount of time the damage that they had done. I mean, they were saying, and I don't know if anyone here knows this, the brothers that initiated that swastika are Jewish. So they really, truly did not think past the next 5 minutes when it was going to go viral and everyone was going to see that, you know. And you know, the two brothers, they're actually working with my rabbi. They're at my congregation, and they have a lot of, you know, self-reflection, you know, to do right now. But they did not understand the significance of a swastika. And, you know, I mean, they see things in pictures, but they don't realize how that's going to affect the world around them.
Right.
So
that their actions have repercussions.
Yes.
And so on.
Yes. Yeah. And they were, you know, some of them were crying, saying that, you know, their Jewish friends are devastated. Mm-hmm. And now they know why, you know, that now they realized what they had done.
What they had done.
You know, when it was too late.
Well, one of the reasons I like the story and I appreciate your part in it is because I think we're living in times where things are so divisive and, the public discourse is so coarse much of the time that it can feel like there's no reason to have these conversations across the aisle anymore. Mm-hmm. We can decide that the other side, whatever that may be, in from where your perspective is, that the other side is not worth talking to. And I appreciate that it was young people in this case, but also I think some of their parents, I heard, it was some of this was a revelation for them, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So that my head of school, Dr. Jeff Davis, he received an email from one of these kids. And funny enough, it was the kid who was sitting right beside me the night before, you know, at the house.
Right.
He reached out to Dr. Davis and said, you know, if there's anything we can do, you know, and we'd love to come and apologize to your students. He goes, you know what, I'm going to take that kid up on his offer and I'm going to bring them here. So he took them on a tour of TVT a few days later, and they spent 3 hours with me doing like a Holocaust intensive study with their parents. Their parents didn't leave, although they were given the option. They wanted to stay.
Right.
So the parents would come up to me just crying, like, I had no idea. I had no idea, you know, all of the little details. It's not, you know, and the poor, the girl who, she got expelled from her Catholic school in South Orange County. She looked at me and she said, you know, 70% of what you just taught us, we don't get in school. And they were saying that even in AP classes, AP history, whatever, they get like one lesson on the Holocaust, if that, you know, one day is spent, maybe two, but not, you know, not even in an AP class.
Right.
So there were a lot of things. She said that at the Catholic school, they're of course told that the Holocaust happened. They're shown pictures of concentration camps or death camps, and she said, and we're told, you know, that a lot of people died, and then that's it.
Right, right.
So there's no lead up.
Right.
There's no, you know, what did the survivors do afterward? Mm. You know, there's nothing.
Well, and I think while we all human beings have a natural capacity for some level of empathy, I think empathy is also a muscle that we develop, and we have to practice it. We have, you know, education is one of the ways that we expand our world, basically, and our understanding and compassion for other people. So I think for me, it's a story, ultimately, as disturbing as it was, it becomes a story of hope, because it's a story about people who responded and people who were able to engage in dialogue, and it sounds like real learning took place.
Oh yes. Yeah. I told these kids, I'm going to send you to the best, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to teach you. I'm going to send you to the executive director and the president of the LA Museum of the Holocaust, who are my friends, my colleagues. They took them, you know, we all had them up at the museum. And they met, you know, Renee Firestone, who is a prominent Holocaust survivor. I know that they were given the opportunity to meet Ava Schloss, who's Anne Frank's stepsister.
Right.
You know, they were so overwhelmed that the Jewish community at large saw that and saw that as an educational opportunity and not an opportunity to, you know, hate them.
Right.
Or, you know, we embrace
just condemn
them. Yeah, absolutely. That this was an educational moment.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. No, I really appreciate that response, and I think that's a response that people who are trying to make a difference. I've been struggling over the last couple of years in particular.
Yeah.
It's easy for us to sort of sit in a place of cynicism and decide that there is no opportunity for change. And admittedly, I think there are sometimes barriers that make it more difficult to get through to some people than others. But at the same time, if we ever stop our efforts to try, then I think we are moving into a place of hopelessness.
Oh,
and I know that's not what this community is called to do, or your community is called to do. we are called to actually keep that hope alive in concrete ways.
Absolutely. I think that was a test of character, too, mm-hmm. because, you know, I was disappointed in a few people in my community who were calling for their heads, you mm-hmm. know, and said, well, these kids are rich and privileged and, you know, they're hateful. They're Nazis. You know, no, they're not. They're high school kids who desperately need education. And, you know, I told their principal, I'm at your service. I will be there to help you. You know, let me know what I can do. Yeah. So they actually met with a group of my students at Tarbu and had like a lesson on forgiveness, wow. Like a Torah study in a way, and had dinner, and they all, like, they had a chance to chat, like teen to teen, wow. and ask each other, you know, what their reactions were on both sides. And by the end of the night, you know, they were exchanging numbers, and they were friends, and they wanted to hang out again, so... These two communities that would have never met, you know,
that
these
came
friends.
Together in
yeah.
this very, exactly. under these very odd circumstances. But
yeah.
but who would have thought upon seeing the initial headlines that this would be a story of hope
yeah.
and that there would be this kind of response. So my last question for
yeah.
you
yeah.
is, did you have any particular personal learning from this experience?
Oh, my
because
gosh.
As much as you are an educator, I know part of what feeds people who do this kind of work is the fact that you continue to grow in this process.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I learn from my students every day. I learn, you know, even though, you know, we make assumptions like, oh, you're Jewish, you must know everything about the Holocaust. No, my students in my Jewish studies class, you know, they are clean slates. They, I mean, you know, even their family members don't talk about it. So we can't assume that anyone knows anything, you know, the weight of a swastika, you know, that they knew better. I, you know, you want to hope that they do, but, you know, I learn from my students all the time what they need, you know, how powerful education can be in this kind of situation.
And that
never underestimate, you know, the power of education.
And don't assume, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And even their parents.
Right.
Even their parents. So they hadn't received any kind of thorough education about the Holocaust either.
Right. Well, so. And it's one thing, I think, to know some facts. It's another thing to take something into your heart and
yes.
your mind and really hold it in that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, Leslie, I thank you so much for being
oh my
with
gosh.
Us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's yeah. applaud her.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So just briefly to kind of sum this up, this came at an interesting time because this week, it was Tuesday, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the global resurgence of white nationalism, and I'm sure some of you read about that. And that's been the motivating factor behind what, according to them, more than half of this country's extremism-related murders in 2017, according to the Anti-Defamation League. And particularly of interest to lawmakers was the role of the internet in radicalizing terrorists, and there are different examples that were talked about, including the Australian national who gunned down 50 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand last month, and then, of course, last October, Pittsburgh man who killed 11 congregants at the Tree of Life Synagogue. So this is a very real thing that we're talking about that's happening right now in our country, and as we're saying in this morning service, also in our own backyard. And there are consequences to this, and we're seeing some deadly consequences. But one of the reasons I wanted to have Leslie in this morning is because as much as I can talk about this sort of thing myself, it's another thing, I think, sometimes for us to bring another voice of someone out in the community who is, in a very concrete way, doing the kind of work of healing that needs to be done in our country right now. And as our song lyrics said this morning, we have to be open, we have to be willing, because to be hopeless would be so strange. And I think hope, while hope can be an odd concept sometimes, and it can seem abstract and mystical, for us not to have hope would not be our best option in these times. Hope is our best option. And I think we find hope in the concrete realities of people who are making a difference in our world. So Leslie, again, thank you so much for being here this morning. We now have our time of offering. And I invite you to give generously to UUCF, because as I continue to deepen my understanding of the work that I do here and that we do together, I realize we truly are an alternative to some of the things we're seeing in the world today. This work is important, you are important, and we help to make meaning in a chaotic world by what we do. So I invite you to give generously.
For our closing hymn, we will be singing the song, Imagine. So please rise in mind, body, or spirit and join us in singing. Imagine there's no heaven. If you try, no hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people